what's going on? Welcome to The Doug Show. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I'm talking to a new friend of mine, Kyle Orla. And I've been watching his YouTube channel for a few years now, and I decided finally to start asking some of the folks that I follow on YouTube for interviews. Kyle has a guitar fingerstyle tutorial kind of channel, and I started seeing him on my feed a few years ago and just watched more and more. You know, people that watch YouTube videos or listen to podcasts, I feel like I know the guy. You know, he's out there making videos and teaching, and I'm like, oh, this is great. And I look forward to, you know, more videos coming out. So anyway, I'll tell you his bio in a second, but I want to let you know there's kind of two parts to this interview. The first part is about being a YouTuber and how he started, some of the details of getting better, monetizing. He has a Patreon that is going very well for him. And then the second part of the interview, kind of the sound check, we just talk about guitars. So we went on longer than I expected, and I think we could talk about guitars for all day long, several, many hours. We could do a whole, you know, podcast series where we only talk about guitars. So we had to cut that short. But if you dig old acoustic guitars, you'll probably find it interesting. If you don't, we are very into those kind of guitars, and I think you'll hear our enthusiasm. So check it out. I mean, I think it's entertaining regardless. And if you like guitars, then you will really, really love the sound check portion. Kyle Orla is a folk musician and educator from Duluth, Minnesota. An ever student of early folk traditions, Kyle threads the needle between old medleys cloaked in relevant aesthetics. His guitar playing is adventurous, unburdened by convention, but deeply marked by the golden age of the 20s and 30s repertoire. And Kyle is equally versed as a solo artist as he is as a collaborator. He has a couple releases under his name, and he recorded fiddle and banjo for Charlie Parr's last Red House Records album, I Ain't Dead Yet. Kyle has an awesome YouTube channel, and we're going to link to it. You can go check it out. His Patreon page is for folk guitar enthusiasts and is one of the fastest growing archive of tabs and play along videos for finger style players. And that's how I got turned on to Kyle, is just the finger style tutorials and other, you know, cool videos in that kind of area. Super fun interview. I hope you enjoy it too. Thanks a lot to Kyle for spending a lot of time with me. We talked, I think, probably another half hour before and after the recording. And yeah, super nice guy. And I'll just send it to the interview now. Hey, Kyle. It's been good chatting with you this morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I was telling you that, you know, I woke up to like over a foot of snow in my driveway, you know, but... you know, which is still fun. We had a great morning, just a little unexpected.
Yeah. And around here in Colorado, it's been super warm. So like I'm wearing shorts and it's going to be like 65, 70 today, which is really strange for early March.
Yeah. That ain't right.
I want to let people know that we geeked out on guitars for about 20 or 30 minutes. I think the sound check portion is about 20 minutes. It'll be at the end. So if you want to stick around for that stuff, I know it's not why we're here specifically, but it's one of the reasons why I asked you to join me today. So I started getting into, I guess, like fingerstyle guitar and more like traditional music and wanting to play it around the pandemic timeframe, which is, I think, when a lot of people were either picking up the guitar again or picking up the guitar for the first time. And over little time, your video started popping up for me. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Like, I'm trying to do some finger picking. And they were great videos. So I decided to reach out and wanted to talk to you about starting on YouTube, growing your channel. You have a Patreon, which you have a decent number of patrons. It looks like I started contributing to you here recently, and just dig into the details, including like maybe some of the analytics and some of the burnout symptoms that people sometimes face when they're looking at metrics all the time. And you
the big B word, you just laid it down, man.
There, and it's, you know, and you're creating content around music and learning, yeah, and you know, you don't get to share that on your channel. So I know sometimes it's right, an outlet for folks. So anyway, Kyle, yeah, welcome to the show, and tell us just a little bit about yourself and what you do in Duluth, and then we'll get into the YouTube stuff.
Yeah, well, I'm grateful to be here. Thank you. Thank you for asking. It's crazy to know, like, I don't know. I just, when I started the channel, I didn't ever expect to, music is universal. So of course it reaches people from all kinds of corners where you wouldn't expect it, right? So marketing, the marketing side of it, it's like, wow, right, of course.
Yeah.
Everybody plays music. Everybody plays guitar. So it's been one of the coolest things is getting to like chat with and meet all kinds of people from literally the all over the world. For as far as what do I do here in Duluth? Well, right now I'm in, my wife and I own a music school. And I always say it's a school with a lowercase s. It's just a place for guitar lessons. Well, more than guitar, but you know, private lessons. We do workshops, and we have five other people who teach here, and they subcontract, or the subcontractors. And so that's kind of my day to day. You know, I teach guitar Monday through Wednesday. I teach guitar, I teach fiddle, I teach banjo, mainly, well, kind of all styles, but through the YouTube stuff, but we can talk more about, I've been able to kind of garner, you know, a crew of folks who are into the exact styles that I'm inspired by. And you know, for whatever reason, like the way I have to offer. So I'm doing a lot of teaching Monday through Wednesday. And then the rest of the week, you know, Thursday and Friday, I try to just focus on the Patreon page and the YouTube stuff. And as far otherwise, you know, I try to practice guitar as much as I can.
All right.
I feel like I've never, I've been more excited about learning guitar than even now, you know, so.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long has the school been around? I mean, you're running a small business, you're giving people jobs and stuff, which is a whole other thing to manage.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah,
it's a lot. So yeah. How long has the school been around?
The school, it's called the Northerly School for Music, and then it's been around, I think, you know, as a business, 3 years, maybe, you know, somewhere in that. We haven't hit that 5 year mark yet.
Okay.
But before that, I had a I had a private lesson studio, and that this grew into. So, just a quick summary. Around the pandemic, I was a touring, just traveling, gigging musician. And then around the pandemic, I pivoted to teaching. And I also was doing repair. I have a history in repairing guitars, building guitars. And so I started a little business, KO Stringworks, that essentially was just any avenue of me being able to make any dollar with music that wasn't gigging. And so part of that was private lessons. Part of that was guitar repair. Part of that was an online thing that, ended up becoming this YouTube channel and the Patreon page. But really it was just any avenue I could just kind of, you know, find somewhere to like, you know, make a living, scratching a living, playing music. And the lessons thing kind of snowballed out of my ability to keep up with, as did the repair. And then soon, recently, the Patreon page is starting to actually, you know, build into a thing that's more than paying for itself. And so part of my response to that was, well, actually, I'll give it to you this way. I think I've said this before, maybe on the channel, but, you know, I didn't know I was going to become a business person, right? Accidentally, here I am having to know about QuickBooks and having to know about clients and retention and all these things, right? It's not what I started. I just needed to make ends meet through the pandemic. And I asked some business people here in town. I asked, and they're very great family of entrepreneurs. They own a bunch of stuff here in town. And we were just chatting one day, because they're just local folks. and asked them for some advice with my predicament of not being able to keep up with the demand of lessons and of repair. And their response probably works well in their corner, but it wasn't the thing I think works for what I do. And the response was, you know, either you're not charging enough or you just need to say no more. And I'd be curious to know from you, like, you know, if that is the average person's way of growing their business. But in the service industry, which I think teaching and repair is a part of, that didn't work. I can't just say no. I'm here for you.
Right.
So if I say no, that's not going to work. And I can't necessarily charge more because that shoulders out a market of people that need support and care. And so what I decided to do was start the Northerly. This is a very long-winded answer. Sorry. Start the Northerly School for Music. And then that would allow me more time to just do repair. Unfortunately, you can't just find anybody to repair your guitar. So I kind of had to just keep shop there and then continue to work up, you know, my chops on video editing. And that was really like, that's the thing I love doing is thinking about creative ways to teach, which YouTube was an outlet for that on so many levels. And we can talk about that as much as you feel like, but so I basically Northerly, we spread out the student load. We actually now we're able to really find, you know, tailor fit you the right teacher, which is as if you've ever taken lessons, sometimes you don't find the right teacher and it's cool. We have five options. And that actually just happened the other day. One of our students is just like, wasn't working out. And so let's try a new teacher and we'll see how that works. Right. Instead of just leaving. Yeah. Anyway, that's, okay. That's a little bit about that.
Cal, that was a great answer. You're a storyteller. So like that's perfect. And you did, I'm not going to make it about me the whole time, but my initial gut reaction is similar to what those entrepreneurs in your community mentioned, which is you can control the supply and demand by raising your prices, which is one way to sort of scale so that you can earn enough money, especially if you're good enough that you can charge more. However, it has the downside that you described. And then the other is saying no, which is something I really now enjoy doing because there's not enough time to do everything. Have you read the book 4,000 Weeks? Do you know this book?
No. I'll write it down, man. I'm an avid reader and I'm a nerd, so.
Good. Okay, so 4,000 Weeks is by Oliver Berkman. Essentially, 4,000 weeks is the average lifespan, something like 74 years. Punchline of the book, I kind of told, like, you don't have enough time to do everything you want to do. Even very good choices of using your time, you don't have enough time to do all that. So you must say no to some very good ideas that you should not spend your time on. And as I'm getting older, past middle age now, I'm like, you know, I'm not like, I don't need to spend time on that. It needs to like really be distilled down. So it kind of changed my outlook after I read that book. So definitely worth checking out.
Yeah. Well, to your point on that too, I ended up, the repair thing was recently cut out and I do enjoy saying no, but I can't, I mean, it's a personal thing probably too, but like, if the tool is there, in this instance, if the bench is set up and I have the tools and somebody's like, my guitar is broken, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And it's just my nature. And I got a great line of advice once from a video maker, who's also a freelancer. This is when I was gigging more. This is a long time ago. I was in college and I was taking these shit gigs, playing bass in like cover bands, and jazz band. And I love jazz. I love a good old cover band, but it was too much of a mediocre thing. And then it just soiled the whole deal. Right. And I didn't have enough creative outlets that really nourished the deeper thing. So, we're talking shop about freelancing and I was like, man, I'm just tired of these shit gigs. And he goes, oh, just sell your bass. I was like, I can't sell my bass. Actually, my principal instrument in music school was bass. But have you ever seen me play bass in a video?
Never.
Now I think about music from the bottom up, right? So it's no matter what you do in life, it's never, to me, like if it's educational and it was good for your moment in life, I don't think it's time wasted. But you got to let it go when it's time. Then you're wasting time, right? Like I'm bass served what I needed and it wasn't serving me anymore at that point. So he goes, sell your bass. And then when they call you, you literally can't take the gig. And so I did, man. I sold my bass. Bass major. Don't have a bass. Smart. To this day, I don't own a bass. Well, the studio has a bass.
Yeah, yeah.
I have one bass student and she's awesome. I'm glad I can play bass. But all that to say, bringing it back to repair, his voice is in the back of my head, you know? So I didn't sell my repair stuff, but it is in the depths of my garage. And, you know, every few days I'll get a text from an old client or a buddy and I'm just like, hey, man, I can't. I literally can't do it. And I should have said that a long time ago because, to your point, the 4,000 weeks, like, I don't got enough time to fuss on that. Like, I got to fuss on my guitar.
So you did your time. And I was about to ask if you went to music school. So the answer is yes on that. And I realize I need to push the interview along to get to the YouTube stuff. Otherwise, I won't get to ask the meaty questions. So one thing that I observed, and we got an example in your question before, you're a great storyteller and you're a teacher as well, as you've explained. And one of the things I noticed in your videos is you structure them really well. And you say, hey, we're about to learn this. You go through it and you're like, oh, we did learn this. And by the way, maybe check out some other videos on this specific topic, which is kind of a playbook for creating videos. So I want you to talk a little bit about how you approach the content ideas at first, and then how you structure that into a video. And it's a lot. So you could answer part of it, take a pause, catch your breath if you need to, and just tell us about it.
I'll try to break it up, man, and I'll try to leave room for your curiosity because, I'll just start by saying I started this idea through the pandemic, as I maybe briefly mentioned. Prior to that, touring and gigging musician, but I need to just give you a bit of context. A touring and gigging musician who was very much like a Luddite and old school. A part of that is like... maybe partly by nature, I just never really liked. I like older things, and so an iPhone doesn't fit that mold. Now I did have a phone, but it was a flip phone. But I part of it too was just when you get into music, and I'm curious if you had this feeling yourself. But like a part of it is embodying the whole thing. It's not just the chords. It's not just the notes, and it's putting yourself. Of course, you're never going to have the scenario that somebody had, like, but part of it is just like, hey, you know, I'm into music from the 1920s and I just want to roam around and hitchhike around the country and just have that life experience in my own way, connect me to the music. So when I started doing the YouTube stuff, man, I had no idea what I was doing. I remember doing like a video project in high school. That's it. So I ended up, I got a phone. But I didn't make my first videos with that. I made my first videos with the Sony ZV-1. You familiar with that camera?
I don't know. I've heard of it.
Don't recommend it. Okay. I don't recommend it. It looks fine. It doesn't look that much better than your phone.
Yeah.
But it has a lens that's integrated and it stopped opening. Right. And so that's dumb. Yeah. So I ended up getting the Sony ZV-E10. Got a grant to do that. The whole thing was grant funded in the beginning. So my time was paid for. Yeah. It was the pandemic. Minnesota is great for grants. So I was able to like right out the gate have a project that was paid for. Now I didn't have any plan. I didn't know how to make videos. I didn't understand anything about it. I knew they sucked. Okay. I had taste, but I didn't know how to execute it. And, so I just spent a lot of time. I'm going to steal a line from one of my students. I've gotten good at things before. And I know a part of that is sucking bad and just sucking through the suck, right? And so, anyway, one thing that helped me See, this is just my nature. This is how all the videos are, right? I got to build some context, but there's the context. One thing that helped me though was realizing my strengths, and I know that one thing that makes a good song a good song, or a good chord progression, is tension and release. And that's evident. That's self-evident in music. Like, so if you have a C chord and then you move to this chord, right? That's tension. But if I go here, that made that tension all worth it, right? So I try to frame my videos like that. I think about it musically. And I try to lead with curiosity, and that everything leads to another question, right? Because that's how music works too. Every chord leads to another chord that's questioning. It doesn't mean it has to be tension. Like, this is tension. But tension can be this. Right? That still leaves me with a sense of openness and questioning. Like, what's going to happen next? Oh, didn't do what I thought I was going to do. Right? So that's how I think about my videos. And it's literally an endless, I don't like script things out like word for word, but I do draft out question and answers. And then from there, I just spitball as we're doing right now, right? You ask me, it's almost like I'm interviewing myself, I guess, but I ask myself questions and then I answer them. And I try to answer them in a way that leaves things resolved, not enough to like confuse anybody, but the resolution is okay. Now you have an awareness of something that you didn't know about, which should give you a new question. So that's kind of how I think about videos. It's probably weird. I bet most people don't think that way, but
how many videos do you think you recorded and published before you thought these are getting pretty good?
Well, I still think they suck. So I don't know about that. Well, not suck, but I still, when I watch it back, I'm like, I didn't hit it. Okay. What can I do next time? That made sense to me, but on the playback, I think someone's going to be confused. Oh, next day there's a comment. Someone's confused. So I'm pretty, without being overly critical, I'm somebody who I have a knack for like self-assessment, even after teaching in person, after this interview, I'm going to self-assess, like, what could I have said clearer? Or did I need to run on that tangent? Did I even come back after that tangent? But to answer your question succinctly here, I think probably 50 videos or something like that, of 50 videos of giving a shit. Let me say it that way. Because the first videos, I didn't give a shit. I had a grant to fulfill. I had no idea what to do. It was really fun. It was the funnest thing I'd done since learning guitar. You know what I mean? And the editing part was fun. And, you know, a few years later now that, you know, we can talk more about when I started giving a shit and why, but eventually I did. And I got really into the editing part. I thought that would help the storytelling. It probably did, but turns out it started to get less fun. And so now I'm kind of like at a point, and I very recently, where I feel like I have enough chops that I don't have to edit it so much. I know a little bit more about how to create a arc that makes sense, where it's not just like, here's the thing, take it or leave it. Like, it's like, well, here's the thing. Do you know the thing? Because here's why it's the thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the thing. Yeah. But it took me a long time, I suppose, but I had a leg up in like being a folk musician. A part of being a folk musician is context, is the story. You know, how many John Prine concerts did he talk more than he sang, or whoever, right? Like Ramblin' Jack Elliot. He's called Ramblin' Jack Elliot for two reasons, right? One is the traveling, the other is the storytelling. So,
all right. So you did feed me a couple questions here, but before we get to when and why you started giving a shit, I went to ask you about the business model, because in the beginning you said, I got a grant. I was going to make videos. lockdown was happening, so you couldn't tour and stuff. Everyone, well, we didn't know what was going on. So now when I look, I see, okay, YouTube is a funnel for a lot of stuff. It gets recognition. You've built up a great following. You can get, you know, local students if they happen to be around, but more likely you get, you know, the Patreon supporters or other, you know, members on your channel. There's a lot of ways to, you know, in air quotes, monetize and make it worth your time so that you will continue doing it. Cause the fact is, like, even if it's really fun, if it costs money, and I was telling you before my other show, I was like, I'm not covering costs. Like, I need to do something or I'm going to quit. Cause like this, only 4,000 weeks, right? I'm over halfway done. So,
Don't say that.
Well, you had to think about it all the time.
I know. And then
anyway, you have the business model in place now. So when did you think, so I see that some people are earning money and I can make this fit into your overall business and livelihood?
Well, it's YouTube's funny that way too, because the people who get all the attention, the Rick Beatos, Rhett Scholl, it seems completely unattainable. Millions of followers. It probably takes millions. And then even like, I feel like Rick Beato, I don't think his videos are monetized even because of the labels, and he's a moving target, right?
Right.
I'm not sure, that could be incorrect, but either way, you see that and it's like, oh God, I don't want, I mean, even like Rick's the top dog and like, he seems like he can't even make a dime. Right. Of course, then you think more clearly, he has courses, right? He has probably old royalty check. I mean, there's so many different ways he's probably doing fine. He's got a lot of gear. He's probably doing fine. I don't think that wall of guitars has shrunk at all. Yeah. Anyway, I remember, you know, seeing that, and actually I didn't really know YouTube. I will say this, when I started making the channel, I didn't know about YouTube channels. I didn't know that a Rhett Scholl channel was a thing. You could make money. That was discovered through my project of doing this, like, and that might lead to your next question. So I'll leave that one. But, you know, I think eventually what happened is the grant money ran out, and I had infrastructure, you know, I had the camera, I had the computer, I had the stuff. And I noticed that a lot of my friends through lockdown who were doing this very thing, once gigs start up again, it's like, shut it off. Like, they shut it all down. And I didn't have, at this point, I didn't have a vision or anything with the YouTube channel, but I did think it was weird to just shut it down. Mm. I was like, I don't think I'm just shut this off. Like, just started it and it's kind of fun. Yeah. And so, the business model, if I'm answering your question here, the business model just started through an evolution of enjoying what I was doing, realizing that it took a lot of time. And I had started this whole, remember this whole KO Stringworks thing where it's any way I can kind of, I had a meeting with a business person once, and I remember asking her in the meeting when we're making this whole LLC thing, just like, so I do like gigs and I do repair and I get some online stuff. Like, is that okay? Again, no, I got nothing. I'm coming in this completely cold. She goes, it's your business. You can do whatever you want. So that like sat with me. I was like, cool, I'll do whatever I want. And So I just kind of slowly, as the KO Stringworks thing grew, realized, okay, this is supposed to be part of my little business. And can I make it a way that it's actually, you know, fulfilling, at least paying for itself, right? Can I make a way where it's paying for itself?
Right.
So that's kind of how the thing evolved. Yeah.
And then the other portion is like, and I think you were leading into it, when and why did you start, you know, giving a shit? You know, the grant money ran out and then got to pay bills. Yeah. So what happened?
Yeah. Two things. One, it started to work a little bit, right? I wasn't just screaming into the void. There were a few people that were early from early what's the word, adopters or whatever, like they saw what I was doing, like people that I admire, and they were like, hey, this is cool, you should do this. Charlie Parr was one. Nat Myers, I don't know if you know who Nat Myers is.
I don't think I do.
Nat Myers, oh dude, check Nat Myers out. Okay. He used to play at Kalamazoo. I don't think he does anymore. A few other people, Tony Policastro, just people I admired, were like, hey, this is cool. They probably were like, it's not very good, but there's something there, right? I can only guess, because the early stuff, man, I watch it back. I'm like, I can't. Oh my God. So bad. But that's remember, you got to suck through the suck. You just got to suck for a long time. And so, that's part of it. I definitely have to mention that. But the real thing was having a kid. We had our first kid, and that's when it's less about my 4,000 weeks, you know, and more about his. Mm-hmm. And that's it, man. So if I'm going to do anything, it's better make his 4,000 weeks kick ass. And so I made the choice then to like, okay, I like doing the videos. Is it as fun as it was? No, but it's still fun. Mm-hmm. And I do see the reach now, okay, I'm not screaming to the void, you know, like there's a little more reach than before. I see the potential. And what I decided to do was I gave myself a timeline. I don't remember if it was 6 months or a year, but it only took 6 months less. Where I was like, I'm right now, my YouTube channel, you could even call it that, is just essentially the Kyle Show. And I can put on it, can put whatever I want on it. Maybe it's going to be fingerstyle guitar. Maybe it's going to be guitar repair, because I was doing that at the same time. Or maybe it's going to be an interview with somebody. And it was just the Kyle Show. I said, just focus on fingerstyle. You have an audience there. I have endless amount of repertoire to talk about and concepts to talk about, like literally probably could go forever doing that, depending on how how deep you wanted to focus and like how stay narrow but go deep kind of thing,
right?
So anyway, I thought, let's just try that, and then, you know, 6 months or less, it just worked. The Patreon page like went from like, you know, 100 people or something, who are probably like in the true fan part of the thing, which is important, right? To just like bring in the opening the door. Who's coming in? There's fingerstyle stuff here. Doesn't even matter that it's me. Maybe it slightly does, but mostly I actually had something to give them. And so yeah, having our kid, and then if I can figure out a way to make this work, I'm all in. Otherwise, probably going to just kind of be a thing I might do sometimes. And because it's his 4,000 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get into some of the like nuts and bolts of like publishing. So how often were you publishing during that 6 month period? Because and we'll do some sort of quick hitter kind of thing.
Yep.
So we're publishing pretty often.
Publishing once a week on YouTube, plus on Patreon would have been probably three times a week.
Okay.
So I would do some kind of thing for my kind of middle of the road supporters. We'd get something on Sunday, which is essentially just a song that I'm analyzing. And then middle week would be like a teaser for the main tutorial. And then the main tutorial also includes like materials that are only available on Patreon. So really four things a week. Actually five. Sometime one time a month would be five things, because that middle of the road supporter gets like a longer in-depth concept lesson. That's something like this, just like talking. Yep.
Got it. Interesting. Okay. And then when you were, you know, you're publishing on YouTube, you're publishing on Patreon even more to make sure that the folks that are supporting you are actually getting like extra, like more stuff.
Yeah.
Like, how long, if you could estimate, were you spending just like creating the content and editing it? Like, is that like 40 hours? I mean, you're doing a lot of stuff, right?
Right. Well, that's part of the, like, I'm trying not to be an editor anymore. I do like the bare minimum. Anything that helps the storyline be concise, if I ramble, chop it, or whatever. Text on the page, if it'll help. Little people like the little guitar grids. You know, I'll do that sometimes. But yeah, just, yeah. Yeah, how many hours? I probably should know. I'll say this. I record it on a Friday. I record it on Friday. I try to chop it up and make it pretty much done Friday too. And like on Monday, I give it a once over and then it's done, you know? So okay. That's like a full day on Friday, like a full work day. So we'll call that 8 hours plus maybe like another couple hours or something on Monday. But then I'm still thinking of ideas. It's an endless thing, but that's how my mind works anyways. I'm endlessly thinking of things. So, but yeah. So yeah, it's, I was given that advice once too, as a self-employed person, you should count your hours to make sure you're making the value you need. I'm not there yet. I'm still just in the, just doing enough to do enough.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. Probably not very good advice for your clients, your team to hear there. Sorry. But
No, it's all good. I was going to say, like, I don't pay too much attention now. However, I think it could be an interesting exercise just 1 week. What you would be looking for is like, am I wasting time on a thing? Like, am I spending a lot of time when I actually shouldn't spend any time at all? And you may figure that out. Yeah. But it sounds like you've refined it already.
I've refined it and I've kind of like given myself almost blocks. Like, all you get is Friday and you get some of Monday. Better be done. If it's not done, then you got to squeak in hours early morning or late at night, and that's on you. Yeah. So I'm kind of hard on myself a little bit, I guess, but it works to give myself these heavy parameters because it gets it done. Good enough is good enough. But you know, there are other things I want to be doing too that are like, practicing guitar is more important to me than editing a video. But editing the video is, well, it's of course important, right? But I got to get it done. I have to get that done. Yeah. So I've kind of recently, kind of in the new year, actually giving myself more of a schedule. Mm-hmm. Woody Guthrie has this great New Year's resolutions thing. I made a video with Charlie Parr about it once. It's fantastic. One of them is work by a schedule. And if Woody Guthrie said that, and Woody Guthrie was, I mean, he was hustling stuff left and right, man. I mean, yeah. You wouldn't call him an entrepreneur, but he was. And Charlie Parr talked a lot about this with me once. I think Woody Guthrie would have a YouTube channel if he was alive. He would have a YouTube channel because it's a way to talk to people as yourself with nobody in between. And that was not an option for a long time, right? It's pretty special.
How'd you meet Charlie? That was one of the, or some of your videos with him are some of the first that I saw, I believe.
Oh, sure.
On
cool.
Your channel. And yeah, I love Slide. I have a couple nationals and that was like what sucked me in, like playing again and fingerstyle and all that stuff. So yeah, how'd you guys
nice.
Meet?
Well, he's from Duluth, you know, I don't know if you knew that. He's from my hometown. Okay. So
you saw each other.
I would have saw him. I mean, basically, not to give you the whole story, but I was coming up, going to the bar he played at when I was underage. But if you went in early, you could stick around. You just were upstairs and hide out. Yeah. And then you could sneak everybody's beer that they didn't finish. Right. This is great. And anyway, I got to know him through that. Eventually he noticed me, and I don't even know how he knew I played music, but his washboard player would take a break. Charlie would just play for 3 hours straight. And I would sneak in and play washboard during the washboard player's break. And that was fundamental schooling for me, sitting in there. So anyway, long story short, we got to know each other just through the years. Charlie is one of his gifts is just, he can recognize people's strengths and interests, and his bullshit detector is fantastic. So I think he just realized that I was kind of in it, you know, I was signing up for life with this music. So, yeah.
Jumping back, I alluded to it before, but burnout is a real thing for creators, especially for people that are listening and watching. Like, basically we have a lot of analytics, and then our livelihood is coming from the content we're creating. And then you get so much data on analytics, and there's pressure to create more. And you're like, well, maybe I'll publish 2 videos per week or 3 per week. And then everything goes up, and you're like, well, I better keep this up. And it's hard to balance it. And it can be very stressful if you don't get out ahead of it. And I'm curious if you've faced that and how you've dealt with it over time.
Yeah. I have had burnout, not from YouTube yet, but I hope I never will because of the lesson that I got from before. So I got burnout as a live musician right before the pandemic kind of shut it all down. And that might have been part of why the YouTube thing felt like so good, just to be creative. And it you know what I mean? I felt like, I feel creative again. Playing live music in a bar room all over to nobody, you know, is just like crush your spirit. Too much of that. You know, again, too much of like a mediocre thing. It's just, it'll ruin the whole thing. So you have to have some wins, right? And I wasn't getting any. And so I had burnout I just didn't want to go to the gig. Mm. And I didn't want to practice. It was over. Quitting was not on the table. I had no other skills but be a dishwasher. And that's the thing I still say to myself. It's this or the pit. It is this or the pit. Because that's the only job I've ever had. And I could maybe I could get a job doing something else. But like, my resume is self-employed musician, dishwasher. So anyway, I had burnout from that and it sucked. I don't know if it was clinical, but you know, it sucked. And as far as like YouTube thing, how do I maintain that momentum without feeling that same thing? I think part of it might be this like strict kind of like, hey, you only get to do this for this much time. Make sure you're spending time doing the thing you also love, spending time with your family, you know. If you care about things, you have to care about them. Right? That seems obvious, but say that to yourself sometimes. You care about your wife, you need to care about her. Care for her. Your kid, your instrument. Care for your instrument. You care about it, right? Tony Polcastro said a great one once. Don't leave your guitar anywhere you wouldn't leave your baby. Right? You need to care That's about true. That thing. Would you leave your baby in your car? It's negative 30. I hope not. You know, that's a part of the self-care thing. And I don't mean to say I don't look at analytics. You know, when I post a video, it's your curiosity is it's right there. Just look at it on your phone. It's very easy to see how a video does. Usually the videos I really like that I'm like, man, this is cool, don't actually do that well.
Yeah.
like I did one on the Jacob Collier tuning. And how they convert it to 6-string. He has a 5-string tuning. I saw that Paul Davids interview and I was like, man, that's sick. But you know what? You could do that with a 6-string. And it's just like not my audience was like, who the heck's Jacob Collier? I'm here for Blind Boy Fuller. Yeah. Even though I did kind of package it in a way that was like, this is actually very similar to an old time banjo tuning. But again, that's old time banjo, not fingerstyle guitar. Part of my thing though is like, you know what, I'm not doing anything I want. Like, I'm not making a video about, you know, filing my nut slots now, or like I'm not doing guitar repair, but I still think it's important to like be true to who you are and your interests. Mm-hmm. And so I do post things that I probably know at the gate won't be a banger, but like, then there's the other side too, where something that's not a banger, but like I'll get Patreon emails like boom, 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 boom. I got a bunch of new patrons. And so that's the thing I'm really interested in now, because you're building a community. Mm-hmm. And like, that's what I look less at the analytics on the YouTube video that is telling, but Also, like an old video might just take off too. So it's actually not that telling.
Right.
But the analytics for the emails of YouTube, it's like if I post something and then that same day I'm getting like a bunch of new patrons, that tells me that was probably good for everybody. Yeah.
So when you find that and you're like, oh, this one was good.
Yeah.
Do you then look at that? Do you figure out why and then do more of that? Like, are you taking it to that level?
Yeah, sure. Why wouldn't I? You know, I think that's, you'd be silly not to. It's like having a hit song. It's like, oh, you got to figure out why Wagon Wheel worked. Better do that one again.
Yep.
So yeah, I try to, I've gone as far as like almost just duplicating the right title, the same title, you know, just like try it again, a new video.
And it works most of the time, right?
Yeah, kind of. It depends on, there's such a, the creative aspect on YouTube too, that's outside the video, is the title marriage with the thumbnail thing. And so it's like sometimes the title works really well for the other video because of the thumbnail, because that particular title and that particular person, right? It's just like, I'm trying to think of an example. Like, I think I had one video I remember did really well, like right away, how Bob Dylan wrote the perfect folk song. And then there's a picture of Bob Dylan who writes folk songs. And then a thing that's above his head that said he broke all the rules. Right. And so there's kind of a fun, like
perfect,
you know, playful thing about that. Right. It's like, it was perfect because he broke all the rules and there's his face. But if I did that with a video about me, how did I write the perfect folk song? I broke all the rules. It's not going to do the same, you know? So there is, you got to look at all the ingredients. And that sounds like burnout.
Yeah, it sure does. Interesting. So I think I made it through like four of the questions, because there's so much to talk about. But I know we only have a little bit of time left. So a couple others, long form versus different formats versus like your own interests. So you do interviews sometimes.
I do.
You published one with, you mentioned Tony and Charlie. So you guys were sitting around and it was just like y'all hanging out, which was fun. And yeah. Other times, I guess, since Charlie's roughly in the neighborhood, he can record with you sometimes. And other videos are more of a, you know, a format of 10 minutes, you cover a thing. So how do you decide on what the format is going to be, while understanding like some people are not going to watch like a 40 minute interview or whatever?
Right. Well, I'm still figuring that out. You know, I think like that Tony and Charlie video, if you don't know who those people are, I guess we should double down on that too. Like Charlie Parr is like a nationally renowned folk singer, guitar player, and Tony is a guitar player as well, but he has a YouTube channel. I think he's got like 500,000 subscribers, and he has his own platform called Tony's Acoustic Challenge, which has like 15,000 members or something, you know. So getting those two together, the same right place, right time, I was like, I got to do that, right? So there's some things you just have to do, even if it doesn't work for your weekly show's format.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't really do shorts. I've tried that. I tried it, you know. I was in a season of trying a lot of stuff, especially in those earlier days where I was like, this is fun. I'm sure I'll do a short. I'll make a comedy short. Don't do it. I don't watch shorts. The things I do, I'm trying to, you know, the things I do watch, you know, the channels I watch are, man, they're no edits, one cut, long, you know, deep dives.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff I really like. So I am going longer a little bit, less cuts, because that's the stuff I like. So, you know, probably end up that way a little bit too, but yeah.
All right. So we're coming towards the end, so I'm just making sure we keep everybody around here. So we got one, where do you see this in the next 3 to 5 years, if you could predict? I hate these kind of questions, but if you have an answer, we can talk about it.
I could predict?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but I'll put it this way, I guess. I know things have like a, you know, you have a much larger audience on YouTube than I do, but it's like I had 10,000 subscribers last year, and I only know that because I went on tour and I advertised that in the bio. This year it's almost 40. We're starting the year with almost 40. So that's a simple math, right? Mm-hmm. In a year. Now, will it always, what is that, triple? Will it always do that? I don't know. But like, you know, I do see it, you know, getting to a point where it's sustainable, you know?
Yeah.
Hopefully I'm able to, you know, we've got the Northerly here too, right? And so that's our music school with the lowercase s. And hopefully it would be cool to buy a building or something like that, get to a point where we can, like, you know, be more in control and have more studios. We only have three right now. And it's so multi-use. I still don't have a situation where I can just have a camera set up. Like, I have to set it all up and, like, you know, this is my light, you know.
Oh, okay.
You know, I haven't invested fully. You know, my camera's all right. I got the Sony FX30. Yeah. But, I'd love to be at a place where I can just turn it on, be creative, and not have to worry so much about, like, ah, dang it, the light. Yeah. You know, because I am an artist, so I do care about that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
More than I wish I did, but I do. I want it to look nice. So, yeah, that would be cool. 3 to 5, that would be amazing if we bought a building. But I don't know, but that would be sweet.
Yeah, I mean, the trajectory you're on, it seems totally like within reach, and every business is different, but just from my experience and my observations, like, you have like some cool growth, probably more than you expected in a year. Like,
yeah,
things when you're at the level that you're at, like, they could grow much faster than you expect, and you're like, oh shit, I
right,
this exceeded expectations by quite a lot, and everything's really good. So if,
yeah,
you know, the algorithmic gods smile upon your channel and keep pushing it. I mean, and you're
Uncle Al.
Yeah. Uncle Al. Okay. I did see, you're working on a book. Is that correct?
I'm working on a lot of books.
Okay. I'm curious how the process is going.
Yeah. I realize how hard it is.
It's real.
Yeah. And there's a lot of options out there for fingerstyle blues by Fred McDowell, right? What does the world need with another one? Who cares that I wrote it? They're already out there. And so if I'm going to do it, well, it just needs to be better than the other ones. Not better by like, I'm a better guitar player, but just the bar gotta go up. I'm not gonna put the same thing out. Mm-hmm. And when I was making it, I was like, this isn't better, it's worse. And I need to, just like through making videos, I gotta know how to get good at it first. I've slowly been working up concepts for a book. And through that, it's something different than it started. So the book thing's kind of tampered down. But I have a bunch of ideas. I'm into a lot of stuff more than old blues stuff, you know. It's, you know, maybe a misconception that I'm creating is that I think that's the best. And my main mission for the channel is, like, I truly believe in, like, these everyday guitarists and that were, you know, recorded in the 20s that are maybe like unsung, in the same way I believe in you as an unsung everyday guitar player. But that doesn't mean that I think Blind Blake is more important than Joe Pass, even though Joe Pass has more eyes on him, right? And one thing I want to, maybe this circles back to your last question, is I want to expand my idea a little more than, I've kind of had some clarity recently, about what it is I'm sharing. And I want to be able to expand that a little more beyond the 1920s stuff that I've shared a lot about. And that I'm glad I did, because there needs to be more eyes and people need to know these stories. But bringing it back to the book thing, as I drafted it, it's like, oh, this is a lot bigger than, this is a lot bigger than just a book about cool Blind Blake licks.
Okay.
So yeah.
Very good. Well, I worked on a book with a friend for, it was about a year or so, but funny enough, it was about anti-productivity and laziness.
Nice.
So we haven't finished it. so we really, which is a true thing. We have like a draft, but eventually both of us were like, I don't know, fuck it. So we pulled back. So yeah, book is it's a big project, especially when you go back and you read
doing
it.
Doing everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that too. So, okay. Kyle, this has been super awesome. We'll hang on and chat just a minute after we finish up here. We'll link to everything, but if people want to learn more about you, what's the number one place to go?
Oh, it's definitely YouTube. I don't know if you'll learn about me. Yeah, you will. I end up sharing personal stories too. Yeah, YouTube, you know, every week, almost every week, sometimes two a week. I'll have a YouTube video on that. But if you want to, and if you find yourself, you know, I would definitely recommend, if you got to be kind of into guitar, dig into it. But it doesn't necessarily have to be Robert Johnson or the old blues players. The idea is that even if you don't know who those people are, it exposes you to it. And that might be the door to the rest of your life, you know? I mean, so yeah, that if you get in, one of the doors you can get into from YouTube, my YouTube channel is my Patreon page. And that's got resources beyond resources, so.
Awesome. Kyle, this has been super fun. Thanks a lot.
Dude, thanks for having me.
I see a couple guitars on the wall behind you and other stringed instruments. But
there's a lot.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite guitars? Like, that's the one you pick up most of the time.
Is this one.
All right. Tell me about it.
That's the one. It's, I can't give you a ton of info about the actual history of it because it's elusive. It's called an Arion. That's the stamp that's in there. But it was one of those catalog subsidiaries of Lyon & Healy, a Chicago company that's still around. And actually, Lyon & Healy just started making catalog era guitars again.
Cool.
It's cool, but it's also, they were like, you know, the affordable option, you know, and we're talking about like the turn of the century, the 1900s, that century. And they were like, you know, all the blues dudes and dudettes are playing on catalog guitars. And I don't know what they costed, $2 or whatever, you know, and you can get it in your Sears Roebuck magazine and send it mailed order to your house. I mean, it's Amazon, right? And so Lyon & Healy started making them again because they actually are incredible instruments, but they're not cheap anymore. they're like, I don't know, you know, a fair price, like $3,000 or something,
right,
for what they are. But yeah, things have changed.
It's kind of
go for it.
Oh, and it's kind of like the Waterloo, which is like the sub brand of Collins, right?
Which is a playoff of the Kalamazoo of Gibson, which I see you have. But this is an Arion, which is essentially Lyon & Healy. I think could be a Regal though. And that gets confusing because, if I wanted a company and I wanted to call it Arion, I could just hire Lyon & Healy or Regal to make it for me. And then I would distribute it. And it's, I don't know, I can't think of a super clear, like analogous to the market today, but I maybe like if you go to Target and what's that?
It's like First Act. Is that the-
well, not even instruments. I'm thinking like, you know, what's that show Fixer Upper? What's that couple called? The Magnolia thing?
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
No.
So Magnolia is the big brand, which... Okay. They have like a network channel. They have restaurants, right? They also have a Target brand, and that's called something else, right? It's got a different name. So, but they have this team or whatever, this infrastructure that makes it. And then the brand is different depending on where it's marketed or sold or something like that. Anyway, is that the right analogous? I don't know. But either way, Arion could have been made by Regal or Lyon & Healy, but distribute it under the name Arion. That is true of a ton of these like catalog era guitar companies. You could also, like, if you had a music store, do the same thing, you know? If you wanted to make Doug music, you could have had Lynan Healy make you a guitar and you could have just put Doug music on it.
Right. Interesting. And that's sort of like a parlor shape. It's small body. It's a pretty wide neck as well.
It's very wide neck. Not too deep. It's extremely light. I mean, it's in the 3 pound, but maybe less.
Okay.
Anyone who picks up this guitar is like, why? Where did it go? Why is it so light? And that's because of a few things. Well, it's dry and old. That's one of them. But it's just very lightly built. The sides are so thin that I actually like leaned in on it one time and just cracked. And I could see how paper thin it was. Thankfully, I have a background in fixing stuff, so it's no big deal. And that's another reason why this guitar is so special is, well, it's the first guitar I bought that wasn't given to me. My first guitar was like a gift. And it was cheap, so that's why I bought it. I didn't know how cool and vibey it was, but it was cheap. And I eventually got into doing repair stuff, and this would have been this was my first like full-on restoration job. It needed everything. Because it was my first one, I had to do everything twice, as you do. So it's had two different fret jobs. The neck's been reset twice. I made that bridge, you know, when I was like 20. But it plays really well now, and it's got a really good, just airy sound. It's not as loud as like a dreadnought, but it has that like woof to the notes that like a big body guitar would have. And part of that, a contributing factor to that is it only has one brace. I know it's called a transverse brace. I don't know everything about why they would have done this, but it does tell you it does date it. And it doesn't make a lot of sense longevity wise, right? It seems like it's going to implode on itself, especially if you put steel strings on it. And so companies stopped doing that and, you know, went with the ladder brace and X brace. Your guitar is probably a ladder brace, right?
Yep.
Your Kalamazoo. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So this is just a transverse brace, one brace here, and there is one brace right there. And the back braces, one piece back too.
Very nice. And then what do you string it up with, just speaking of, you know, it being so lightly braced?
I string it up. I've tried everything, you know. I actually was a dumbass and I put mediums on it at one point. I got this thing when I was a kid. I just didn't think about stuff, you know. It sounded great. I actually, for a while, I had gut strings, like real gut strings on it. That was pretty cool. There's a video of me playing April Kisses by Eddie Lang on YouTube somewhere, like deep in my videos. That's on this guitar with gut strings. We actually have a gut string manufacturer here in Duluth. Okay. they make gut strings for more Renaissance era instruments, early music. So lutes and, you know, theraboes and stuff like that. But they also make strings for guitars. They make banjo strings. So they sound cool. I ended up what I have on here is these String Joys.
Okay.
They're soft touch strings, and they're essentially just like a really light gauge string, but they still, however, whatever voodoo they put in these strings, it still kind of maintains a pretty good tone, like a lot of bass response still there. So, you know, if you put super light strings on, the thing just goes, bleh, you know, it doesn't really do anything. That's what I have on here. I forget. It's like 10 and a half.
Okay.
I think it's like 49. It's like a weird number ratio. Okay. But
In between. Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
There's some videos on your channel so people can go check it out and recognize that guitar. Very cool.
Yeah, I play it. When I'm not playing this guitar, it's in the case here. I can pull it out if you want to see it. It's right there, but it's my Fraulini, which is a pretty great guitar. I also just recently got my first Telecaster.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've been playing that, man.
That's fun.
I got it because... Well, we have a 2-year-old, and I'm trying to keep my practice up, you know? So, you know, I get up at like 5 a.m. every day, and I try to put in 2 hours before he wakes up. Doesn't always work out. And So it's actually my quiet guitar, right? It's just quieter than this. But I have been plugging it in. I did play my first show with it. And I'm just doing the fingerstyle stuff that, you know, I share a lot about online. But it just sounds amazing on a telly. It sounds awesome. I put flat wound strings on it. It sounds amazing.
That's so cool. And I'll tell you a little story about my Kalamazoo back there. So I don't want to go back too far, but I was thinking about when I first was like, I think I want to get a nicer guitar. So I was looking at just smaller body guitars because the Dreadnought that I got 25 years ago, just a little too big. And I'm like, I don't need to play that loud anyway. So eventually I got a Gibson, a new LG2, which was really nice. I live pretty close to Wildwood. So I actually went down there during the pandemic and got it. And then I started investigating the history, which led me to some of the catalog guitars in Kalamazoo, which is a Gibson made. So I got a KG11. I found it on Craigslist, like two pictures, no explanation. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is this a scam? I don't know, but it looked like it could be okay. Emailed the guy who had a studio, and I think he traded a Jazzmaster for it. Didn't really know much about it. So I met him at a guitar center, got it for a pretty good deal. I think like $900 or something like that. As far as I could tell, there were no cracks, and the frets were pretty flat. I don't think it needed a neck reset. Again, I'm not an expert, but when I was looking at it, I'm like, this actually plays pretty decent. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was any overspray or it mostly original from what I could tell. So I got it, and I thought it could play pretty well, but maybe I would need some work because the bridge was it's in rough shape. Like it was kind of coming apart a little bit, but it had 11s on there or something like that. Anyway, I took it down to, it's like the Arvada. It's like the Old Town Pick and Parlor, which is a nice shop. Do you know those guys down there?
There's one in Minneapolis, but is that the one you're talking about? No, this is
there's
not.
One in Denver.
There's probably one. Yeah. They're all over. Yeah.
But there was a guy that worked at Gibson Custom Shop for a short time or something.
Oh, nice.
And anyway, he likes to restore these whatever pre-war old Martin and Gibson. So he did recommend a refret, which he did an awesome job, like total game changer. Like it feels amazing. And then rebuilt the bridge. And I think, it's like under, when I weighed it, when I got it, it was under 3 pounds. It was like 2 and 14 ounces or something like that. Yeah. So like you said, I'm just like, whoa, this is so comfy to play.
And, where is it, man? That's great.
So and I was a little, you know, you refretted that one, but I know some people they are more protective. They want to not refret it, but I'm like, I want to just play it and it's fine.
No, man, you got to refret it if you want to play it. You get lucky sometimes, but if the frets aren't right, I don't care how good it sounds. Yeah. You have to have the right frets. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's not cheap. And what we would do back when I was doing repair, we would just save the frets in a little baggie.
Okay.
And you say, here you go. There's the original, you know, it doesn't, anybody who's going to buy this guitar, you know, that's any museum would understand, like it has new, you know what I mean? It's just like, you got to put the new frets on. It's like not even brakes in your car. Like, you know, so you can't change the original brake lines. Like, no, you can't. You have to. Yeah. It's a safety.
Yeah. And like you said, it is pricey. I mean, it was a lot of work and it took a little while, but totally worth it. And so fun to play. It plays as good as the new, like the brand new LG2. Do you have any like newer acoustics or do you just stick to the old stuff?
My Fraulini is new. Here, I'll pull it out.
Yeah.
One second.
Sure.
So I think it's a 2007.
Okay.
But it looks.
Yeah, it does.
It just looks like the same, right? They're like the same.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Just this one's extremely light. Yeah. this body is a little bigger of the lower bow. It's like a little bit bigger, but they're essentially the same. This would have been like the kind of guitar that Blind Blake was playing. But it's what I gig with. I don't love gigging with that one, you know?
Right.
And this one sounds great with a flat pick or a thumb pick. It's really even. So yeah, this, I have a pickup installed in it, K&K pickup.
Okay.
So it's a gigger, you know?
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. Super nice.
It's great. Yeah. It's great. It's Todd Cambio. He's a guitar builder behind the name Fraulini, out of Madison, Wisconsin. And so he made this particular one for himself, and then he sold it to a mutual friend, and then I picked it up from him. So it's only been three owners, but you know, pretty very special cool guitar. Yeah. Always been owned by, you know, somebody into this style of music too. So it's really only had rags and folk music and, you know,
yeah,
jazz, early jazz played on it.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, but Todd made a guitar for Slash. I think Ben Harper has one. Like Bruce Springsteen has a Fraulini.
Okay.
You know, so he's like in the world of guitar geeks, it's understood that Todd is the best. Right. You don't have to be into pre-war stuff to play his stuff. It's just his stuff. It is
so good.
It's the best. You're supporting a family man and a small maker. And so, yeah, he makes them one at a time. His sons have helped a little bit. I don't know if they stuck with it, but I know through the pandemic they were helping out. And yeah, I have another one of his, a 12 string. That thing's a beast. So
yeah,
I got two Fraulinis. I got, the old Arian. I had a Kalamazoo. I recently sold it to a student of mine, who was looking for a vintage thing. And, I was looking to let go of that one. So I moved that one along, but that was a fun guitar. Funny enough, I ended up using it for flat picking stuff primarily. I got it hoping to kind of do like bluesier. I thought it'd be a great blues box. And of course it is, but I already have a really good, this thing's the bluesiest box there is, the old one. And so I was like, well, this thing's actually got a really even, clear, loud voice, almost like an arch top. And so I ended up doing a lot of stuff, you know, on that, in that realm. But anyway, sold it, you know, you move things along. So right now I've just got the two Parlors, 12 string, and then that Tele. Those are my guitars. Yeah.
All right. We could go on and on about the instruments. But final question.
I'll do it.
we'll have to, have a whole other show for it.
Yeah, dude.
How do you decide to let the guitar go? When is it time? Like that Kalamazoo that you sold.
Well, I got that thing. I made a video about it too. I got it just because like the prices are going up. Gibson's, it's interesting how like if you watch the market, and if any of your listeners are obviously like into like, you know, into watching how money works and investments and stuff, watch the guitar market. It's interesting. Yeah. Gibson and Martin are just kind of switch places, interestingly enough. And I know a really, really a fantastic guitar player, and he's also like kind of a, like Roy Bookbinder, the late great Roy Bookbinder we just lost, he was telling me he didn't make his money playing folk music. He made his money selling guitars on the road while he was playing folk music. And there's a few guitar players in the world right now doing stuff like that. And this particular guy was telling me that he can't ask what he used to ask for Martins, but he's getting to ask more for Gibsons. And I noticed that Kalamazoo's on Reverb, and I'm checking the sold listings, you know, not the asking price, but the sold. Kalamazoo's just kept going up. So I was like, I better get one while I can. And a buddy of mine had a few. Anyway, I wanted to try one out. That particular one, how did I know I was ready to sell it? It was just something I wanted to try, and I knew I wasn't going to be married to it. And that's probably how most of my guitar buying is right now. It's like getting, okay, what are these all about? And just recognizing that I'm not trying to be a collector. Some things I hold on to of, you know, like, okay, this is a good investment. And maybe I'll, you know, hold on to it. And then I just, you know, at some point it's just like, you know, I actually don't have any real investment guitars right now. I've just sold them all. But I do buy some, I hang on to things sometimes for a while with that in mind, but I'm just not very good at hanging on to stuff.
Yeah.
I hang on to the stuff that I know it can give me, serve me. And if it stops serving me, you know.
Yeah.
This is probably the only guitar I'll probably never sell, even though it's the most finicky. This is this old one.
Right.
I don't think I would sell the Fraulini either, unless it was to like the totally right person who I know would just continue the lineage in the way that I – doesn't have to be old time, but just like a player, you know, who's going to gig the thing. The 12 I have too, I don't know if I'd sell that because it was a gift from Charlie Parr. It's just like,
oh wow.
Yeah, he gave it to me. That guy can't hold on to anything either. Yeah. He's worse than me. So yeah, anyway, so there are things that are sentimental. I'm not a super sentimental person, but maybe I am about a few things. And so yeah, I think just like mainly if it stops serving me, the things I've moved, and I've owned a lot of guitars. Mm-hmm. I've owned a lot. Yeah. If it stops serving me, I move it along. Or if I'm like, hey, you know, I doubled my money on that. Definitely makes sense to sell it. So,
yeah,
you know, yeah.
And it makes sense, you know, like you said, if it's going to a good home where it's going to get played and respected and all that stuff, like
totally about that. I can't sell a wall hanger. I won't do it. I won't sell a wall hanger. Yep. Yep. I won't sell it to a house I know is full of just, you know, a bunch of guitars just hanging there. I couldn't do it. So, yeah.